Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth, every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and delighted to welcome all you listeners to Real Talk. We've had some technical challenges here, so things are a little hectic, but we're here, and I'm really excited about today's show. Today, we're going to explore the notion of reparations, a concept often defined broadly as making amends for a wrong. In today's American lexicon, the term refers generally to methods of compensation to BIPOC communities for human rights violations throughout this country's history. As many in the U.S. struggle to define and devise reparations, one group in Seattle is taking action. Africatown Land Trust has been working toward bringing equity to housing since 2017, and I am honored to have as my guest today Africatown's CEO, Kay Wyking Garrett. Welcome, Wyking. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, Wyking. Good morning, and good morning to all the listeners or viewers, and thank you for opportunity to come on and have some real talk about some real issues, because I think that is one aspect of us, working together to shape our shared reality.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up, because in my view, the topic of reparations is one that is fraught with so many different viewpoints. And first of all, I want to hear about Africatown and your process in working toward reparations in Seattle, and then let's go to the general concept. So tell us about Africatown. What is it you're doing, and when did you get started with this?
Sure. Africatown is a community, asset-based community development initiative in Seattle focused on preserving, restoring, and really facilitating a future for the African-American community that has called the Central District and Seattle home for what will be 140 years next year. William Gross was an early Seattle pioneer who previously worked on the Underground Railroad and came and contributed much to kind of developing the city. And he actually bought 12 acres of land from Henry Yesler, another early pioneer, and established a central district as a settling place, and really safe space for Black families to settle as he began to partition off his land. And, migrations happened, particularly, more migrations happened to the area, particularly around World War II, and due to different type of institutional racism, housing covenants and things of that nature restricted where Blacks could live and rent and own, and many things have happened, redlining and many different policies and practices that really inhibited and prevented the community from really growing and prospering economically throughout the decades. And now with, the economic booms of the last, 20 to 30 years and not having equitable participation, the community now faces significant and has already experienced significant uprooting and displacement.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that after World War II, the Central District was more of a thriving Black community than it is now. And then with sort of the crunch of real estate values and redlining and those kinds of systemic racist policies, The Central District has become a more difficult place for Black families, Black middle-class families, I presume, Black families of all economic persuasions to survive. And is that what stimulated, if I'm correct, is that what stimulated the development of Africatown Land Trust?
Yes, that is correct. So through a planning process where we really looked at the Seattle 2035 plan, which is the comprehensive plan for the city of Seattle, part of the Growth Management Act of Washington State, mm-hmm. We really didn't see our community as a part of the future of Seattle. We initiated our own process to really write ourselves into the future, you know, and to be a part of that, you know, future skyline. And that the Africatown Community Land Trust was one of the vehicles that was identified particularly to address the land affordability issue that was causing significant displacement and lack of ability to stay or even come to the community for the Black community, which has obviously experienced a significant income and wealth disparities, as the Seattle area economy has boomed, there hasn't been equitable participation.
So tell us exactly how your process works in Africatown. What is it that Africatown aims to achieve for the Black community, and how do you go about doing that?
Yes, I would say overall, Africatown, as I said, is a community development initiative that is actually beyond the land trust as a specific organization, which is focused on, again, facilitating a future of the historic African-American community, being able to grow and thrive in place and be a part of the future of Seattle, which would then make Seattle a more inclusive and equitable city, which we hear a lot of people desire. And we hear, you know, a lot about the social justice initiatives and, you know, shared prosperity and equitable development. But the on the ground reality, when we look at the numbers, is that we're experiencing still a modern day Jim Crow apartheid. Again, when you look at, you know, the average median income of African-American being at $42,500, average median income for white family at, you know, $112,000, you know,
wow.
And the wealth disparity from nearly $500,000 down to $25,000, right? Those are huge, huge disparities, right? And we know they're not rooted in any genetic defects of one human being versus another human being, but really that there has been systemic, you know, defects that have produced these outcomes and disparities. And so our work is around disrupting that and, again, creating a future. Our you know, our vision is that, you know, a world-class city should be inclusive of the communities of the world that have helped make the city and not, you know, exclusive to just one class, which is what the current trend.
Tell us about the projects currently underway with Africatown Land Trust. What have you got going?
Yeah, so some of the current projects that we have about over 500 units of affordable housing in our pipeline. First project that we were involved in and partnered was the Liberty Bank Building, which honors the Liberty Bank, which was established to give access to our community members that were being, again, denied access to capital due to the systemic exclusion and structural racism for many years. And now the first development that we were involved in was to continue that mission. The bank went out of commission due to factors. And so there's 115 units affordable housing over commercial space, which is prioritized to address that mission of the bank, which is to give access to economic stability mobility. Yes, go ahead.
So are these rental units or are they condos
these
so
are,
people
these
can
are,
buy
these
them?
These are rental units.
They are.
And that's through a partnership with Affordable Housing Developer Community Roots Housing. And our next project is Africatown Plaza, which is 126 units over community and commercial space, which is across the street from the Liberty Bank building. We're repurposing a former fire station, 6, as a William Gross Center for Cultural Innovation and Enterprise to actually create pathways to the innovation and knowledge-based economy in areas of entrepreneurship and workforce that, again, we lack representation in. We are also working on affordable home ownership because we see that as, you know, key ultimately when we look at equity.
Yeah, that's been the traditional American path to generational wealth. And so you are finding ways to provide home ownership for folks. Tell us more about that.
Well, the traditional community land trust model is really focused on single family residential home ownership and reducing economic barriers to that by the land trust owning the land and then the home buyer only needing to, you know, finance the improvement. And that is a mechanism for ensuring permanent affordability. So if the homeowner decides to sell, then the next home buyer would have access to, again, that affordable home ownership opportunity. We kind of took a different path as residential, you know, affordable rental, multi-use, you know, at larger scale buildings were our initial projects, but we are working towards, again, that affordable, greater affordable home ownership opportunities through our work as well.
Is it where the Africatown Plaza will go? Is that
We actually wanted to bring we worked and explored bringing affordable home ownership into that project, but you know, based on the existing financing sources, we were not able to make that pencil. So that's a problem that we're still working to solve. We do have land which is designated for affordable home ownership that we're working through at this time as well. And then our most recent acquisition is at 16th and Yesler in the Central District of Seattle, a square block which was formerly the Cato Assisted Living Center was, you know, sold, and there was going to be market rate development proposed for the site, and community really rallied to say that we need anti-displacement, you know, projects at the site, affordable housing, and so.
So that's really interesting to me because I know the developers in Seattle are pretty rabid. How do you get around that? Do you work with the city council to entice folks to let go, if you will, of their rabid development ideas?
I think there's a role that, you know, city council can play in terms of what it incentivizes. You know, obviously upzoning, you know, land use changes in the form of upzoning has incentivized developers to want the properties even more because of what they can, you know, profit off of them. But really, this was an example of community voice, you know, thousands of people really, you know, making their voices heard of what was desired, and a developer who said, you know, well, we will divest. We don't want to be in this, I guess, contentious process with community at this scale. And they ultimately presented the opportunity for us to acquire the property for approximately $14 million, which we just completed that transaction in early October. And We were able to access some of the funding sources that supports affordable housing. Obviously, there's a homeless crisis, which a lot of it has to do with the unaffordability of housing.
So, you must be a pretty darn good negotiator in order to get those kinds of deals set. $14 million sounds like a lot, but you're talking about a whole city block, essentially, correct?
It is a full city block, and I wouldn't say that I'm the negotiator. I think we have a very good real estate team that really works through the complexities of those deals. So, big credit to our team there.
Well, you were named one of the 13 most influential people in the city of Seattle, by Ken Garrett, in 2019. What did you do to get that designation?
Been working to make the city where I was born, in the community where I was born and raised, and the world that I exist in and my children exist in, a better place, you know. And I think we've been able to, you know, working with community, have some impact, not just within our community, but raising these issues to a place in public consciousness that is facilitating some action and some policy change as we shape the future, because it's really all of our decisions, right, that create the future conditions, decisions that we're making, or the non-decisions, right? It's inaction and inaction, right, that produces the conditions that we all live with together.
So I think I have the date right. You started Africatown in 2017, is that correct?
Well, that was our first big deal, which was the Midtown Center acquisition, was in 2017. Africatown Community Land Trust was actually founded in 2016. But I think that it really came to prominence in the media in 2017 with that acquisition at Midtown Center.
So that's been, 4 years? A lot has happened in that time. How, if at all?
A lot has happened. Yes.
How, if at all, has your purpose or your process evolved over that time?
I think, you know, one of our areas of strength is just being rooted in principles and framework that guides our work, so that we, you know, because again, so many things happen, so many opportunities, so many directions you go into. We have to be able to really stay focused, right? You know, one project is great. You know, when we had the ribbon cutting for, you know, Liberty Bank building, you know, it's an exciting, you know, historical time, but it also exists in context of so many cranes building so many things that don't facilitate a future for us, that, you know, being able to, again, stay focused on, you know, at what, you know, when we have these projects which demonstrate that another future is possible, that there is another path, how do we then, you know, get that to scale? You know, I think that is where our work has evolved to, from, you know, demonstration projects to saying, okay, we know that this can be done. Now, how do we get the level of resources and the political will moving so that we can really scale this up in the time that we need to do so.
So what kind of obstacles do you have to overcome in that process to get those deals done, to actually come to the point of a ribbon cutting? What are the biggest obstacles you face?
The biggest obstacle, right, is you know, kind of the ongoing elephant in the room. And this is why we've been having the conversation about reparations, is because access to capital, you know, is at every step of our endeavors an issue, right? And we know that Africans who were brought to America, you know, and forced to work and enslaved their labor capital is the foundation for what generated the wealth of the American enterprise and really, you know, the West overall through colonialism. And that wealth was maldistributed, right? It was benefited one group, and our communities that still don't have, that have these access, these barriers to access now, were denied access to the very, you know, wealth that was extracted from them, you know, over 300 years of pretty much chattel slavery. And at the end of that period of time, someone is rich and someone clearly has a deficit of capital and wealth to leverage. And then there's the, you know, again, the systemic practices that persisted from, you know, Jim Crow to redlining to, you know, urban renewal to, you know, just benign neglect of the, you know,
the racist restrictions on the GI Bill.
Yes, right. And so, and one, you know, for those who would like more clarity on this, because a lot of people have a lack of clarity on how these things worked, you know, The Color of Law is a great book that people can read. I think there's The Color of Law, which outlines this from a legal and policy perspective over these decades, and how all this worked to produce the barrier that you're asking about, the primary barrier that you're asking about today, which is access to capital. So when we're seeking to, you know, access what is necessary to make a, to acquire land, develop land, to have general contractors that are, you know, reflective of the communities where these projects are happening and supposed to impact, and business, small businesses to come into these new developments. At each stage, access to capital is a barrier for participation.
So what I'm beginning to understand about Africatown is that you are tackling the notion of reparations through acquiring land, acquiring real estate, creating access for housing and hopefully ownership, as well as supporting businesses. And with the new center that you're creating, also cultural development. From a broader perspective, how many paths do you see this country can take in order to make reparations real and effective?
Well, and I want to say that I don't know that we're tackling reparations by accessing resources that are available to every, you know, in a sense, everyone, right, to use. And so, you know, reparations means to directly respond to a harm or damage or injury that has been done to, you know, provide remedy to bring back to whole, right? And so in a sense, that's a debt in itself. And then you have, you know, I guess fair and equitable participation, you know, moving forward from there, right? And so I think that is one point of clarity, is that, you know, reparations is a debt. It's not charity. It is a debt, and people are benefiting and enjoying the benefits of wealth that was maldistributed, you know, and wealth that was derived from, you know, the worst probably treatment of human beings that we are aware of in recorded history. And that has to be repaired. And part of that is a redistribution of the wealth and benefits that were previously maldistributed. And then we have to just move forward in a more, you know, fair and equitable environment beyond that point. So our work is raising the issue. We continuously raise the issue. But you have to be specific in allocating resources to, again, address that harm. And then you still have the just general welfare of, you know, anyone that's in the society that, you know, needs assistance, right? So there does need to be a differentiation between, you know, kind of more charitable and social welfare initiatives and reparations, you know, in specific for harm that has happened to specific groups through specific experiences here in this country.
How do you see that redistribution of wealth happening in this country?
Yes, I think there's layers to it, right? You know, you have, you know, government that enacted certain policies, including taxation, right, on and derived, you know, financial gain from the enslavement of African American people, Black people, people of African descent. You have corporations, you know, banks, insurance company, you know, different, you know, private companies who also derived and were beneficiaries of the maldistribution of that capital and wealth. And then you have individuals, right, at an individual level. So at each level, I think there is a remedy that is in order to kind of redistribute that access. So a person can take a personal decision and say, you know, I am benefiting, you know, I have benefited, I continue to benefit from this tragedy, and I'm going to take some of the resources that I have direct control over and allocate, you know, which is something that we see happening with the Civil Reparations Project, which I think there's, you know, a group on Vashon that is engaged with that as well. And then again, you go to the corporate and government levels of addressing those issues. So I think there is some precedence. I mean, there is domestic, you know, in this country and international precedence for how reparations are allocated. And, you know, there's multiple, you know, obviously land, access to capital, investment in institutions in the communities to address these issues, direct allocation of finances to the descendants of those who were harmed and again denied the benefit of their wealth are a couple of the ways that I think there's historical context and precedence for reparations has been paid in this country. In actuality, reparations were paid to the slave owners, right?
Yes.
But not to the right. Enslaved, right? So there is a precedence of reparations being paid even prior to, you know, interment of Japanese Americans, mm-hmm. Certain economic remedies that are been directed towards the indigenous people, which I think are definitely still insufficient as this is, you know, their land.
Yeah, what's wrong with this picture? It's right. Way off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where
I mean,
do
I think
you...
just that is a good enough example right. To just say, well, you wrote the check to the wrong
right.
person, right?
Right?
It's like there was a
yeah.
car accident.
Whoops.
It's clear who was at fault, and you wrote the check to the person who was at fault and did not write a check to the those who were injured
yeah, right.
by the fault and the actions of the other. And so they have not yet been made whole.
So when you and others start talking about these kinds of reparations and these approaches to reparations, where do you get the most pushback?
I think the pushback is in the, you know, the context of people who don't want to give up the privileges that they have, right? And so people feeling that whatever they have in life, you know, is strictly a result of their, you know, intelligence, good choices, you know, hard work, right? And so that, you know, I think clouds it, lack of real understanding of how things have happened in this country. And that's why encourage books like The Color of Law or even the article that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote called A Case for Reparations. These are some resources that people can read. And I think, you know, so that's where, you know, pushback, where are we going to get the money from? But we see through this pandemic, you know, trillions of dollars just appeared. We see, you know, money, you know, available to provide aid to countries all over the world, right? But I think the pushback comes from just the deep rooted anti-Blackness that exists in the society. I think people who have, you know, obviously the majority population is white people, people that are considered white, not wanting, feeling like something is being taken from them, you know, and they, you know, and not wanting to, I guess, give up the unearned benefits that they enjoy.
You know, and to me, that's kind of a weak argument. Depending on the path that the government, which to me seems to be the first responsible group, whatever path is taken for reparations, I don't see that people are going to lose a whole lot. It's more about how much we're going to gain. How do you present that argument in a way that that wins, that convinces people that reparations make a whole lot of sense?
Well, that's a great question. I think that mentality is a vestige of the same mentality that said all men are created equal, but still had that these men and women are 3/5 of a human being, and were able to justify that, you know, throughout the, you know, they're conscious, right? And so yeah. I think it's the same thinking on certain levels. So I would, you know, how do we present that? I think, you know, again, just presenting the truth, informing people and raising it up and not allowing it to be swept under the rug, you know, not allowing, well, I didn't own any slaves, to be an acceptable response, right? Or, well, my family didn't come here until, you know, 1900, you know, but really illustrating clearly, these are things that should be taught in school. This is part of American and world history, and one of the most egregious those crimes of humanity that has not been fully acknowledged. There still has not been an apology.
It's not been alone, any apology. No one's. I guess I thought one of our presidents had apologized in some way, but I guess not. I'd like to go to the pot. We have only 2 minutes left. I hate that it gets so short, but I'd like to talk about the politics of reparations just a bit. Because I don't know, and you can tell me, is there more a more welcoming approach to the notion of reparations under the current Democratic administration and control of Congress? And how do you see that going forward if the control of Congress flips to the Republicans in 2022?
We've seen it flip back and forth, you know, decade after decade, and we still haven't seen significant progress by either side. I think it is incumbent upon, you know, all those who are for justice to center this issue, and particularly the Black vote, which, you know, was credited and celebrated for delivering this election.
Right.
But yet we have not heard about this. And so that, I think that's, you know, unacceptable. It's always, we'll get to it next time. We got to win this election. Then we got to get reelected. And then, you know, and so it keeps, the can keep get, keeps getting kicked. And so I think we have to focus on centering this as a number one issue priority to be addressed, and not accepting further delays and denials of justice.
You know, one of the things that has occurred to me is not necessarily connected to our current conversation, but in the last week or so with the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict, and then now with the trial of the people who killed Ahmaud Arbery, I've felt as though there's been a judicial opening of the freedom to kill with minor excuses. Do you, in your community, feel any additional threat from those both discussions and from that Rittenhouse verdict?
I think this is something that we've lived with for the complete existence in this country. So I think right now there's greater visibility on these issues, but Dred Scott decision said that, and Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, these decisions, you know, said that, you know, a black man has no rights that are bound to be respected, right? And so this is what we have seen and witnessed with the failure of the judicial system to bring justice in these instances where our community has been murdered.
Before we go, and I hate to end this conversation, I hope we can do it again. I would like you to tell folks how they can participate in Africatown and what that website is, how they can go and participate in supporting your efforts for reparations.
Sure, they can go to Africatown Community Landtrust.org. Hopefully that can be shared somewhere.
It will be.
Africatownlandtrust.org, Africatownlandtrust.org, and they can participate. And I think, again, back to your initial question, what can people do? They can prioritize investing, making significant investments in Black-led organizations that are doing work that is towards, that is restorative and reparative for the harms that have been done. I think there's significant things that can be done at an individual level as well. People should speak to this issue, raise this issue with their elected officials to, again, make this a priority.
K.Y. King Garrett, I cannot thank you enough for joining us here today. You are the CEO of Africatown Land Trust in Seattle and one of the most influential people in the city. We are honored to have had you on Real Talk. I hope you'll come back. And I want to thank Evan Kim and Rich, who also joined us, I believe, from your group today.
Yes.
To listen in, and Janie Starr here from Vashon, who was our studio audience today. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you, Susan.
And thank you so much for the work that you're doing.
Real Talk is very important. Thank you.
And thank you, dear listeners.